fair enough to know. "Whatever," Francie said. "So, like I said, I heard someone yelling hello, and I waved and said something like, 'You're looking all muscly and scrumptious,' or whatever." "Do you ever let up?" Ding asked her. "I don't mean anything." Francie gave her a quick glance that earned her a sharp word from Miss Maxwell. "I didn't mean anything. It was just something to say. Only Brutus, he took it like an invitation or something because he asked me to wait. He said he wanted to talk to me about our biology lab." "You aren't studying biology."
"Neither is he.
Which is why I reckoned he was sending me some kind of message. Like maybe he wanted to give this girl the chuck and I was meant to help him do it by playing along. And who could blame him with those hideous shorts she had on? Some girls need to be super careful what they show to the world, you know. Anyway, turned out I was right. Brutus gave her some tongue and a hand on the ass when they got out of the kayaks. Perhaps to show her he was all hers or something. No clue there. Then off she went, so he and I could study biology in a serious way. Only it wasn't that kind of biology, obviously."
Ding was beginning to feel hot. The room was warm anyway because of Francie's nudity. Her nipples were nonetheless erect, and she could see that some of the art students were sweating. As for her, the heat came from her outrage, because she could feel it like a coal in her stomach. She said more loudly than she intended,
"So it was his idea? Your idea? Whose, for God's sake?"
Francie gave her a look, then. She asked Miss Maxwell if they could have a brief break. The basket of fruit was getting heavy, she said. 5 minutes? 10? Miss Maxwell agreed to 5, and Francie set down the basket and stepped off the dais. There was a cover-up for her to put on, a striped seersucker affair with a belt. She didn't bother with it, remaining nude instead. She walked Ding over to one side of the room where various cubbies held canvases, drawing pads and other accoutrements of drawing and painting.
"Look," Francie said, "you always said you and Brutus aren't exclusive, so I didn't think it mattered."
"Whose idea?" Ding snapped.
"Probably both of us."
"Ding, I don't know."
"Then tell me what happened."
"Exactly."
Francie shifted her weight. One smooth hip jutted out. Unself-consciously, she scratched her pubes. She said,
"I think I asked him what was with the biology bit.
He said something like he just felt like he wanted something different. He gave me that grin of his. Let's face it, he's rather adorable, even if he is too young for my taste. And I said, 'Different what, or how, or who?' He gave me another one of those grins, and he did that thing when he brushes his hair back and sort of looks at you like, 'I know his routine,'" Ding told her. "Finish up." "So we went to the house. We had a spliff and a snog, that's it."
"Oh, come on!"
Ding's voice rose. Three nearby male artists looked up from their work. She whispered,
"You were on your knees, and that wasn't about praying for world peace."
"Well, of course I was going to blow him," Francie said, "but it wasn't serious. We were there, and he was that Brutus person he can be, and it seemed like—"
Francie stopped suddenly. Ding's eyes had filled. She was furious with herself for reacting in any way, let alone for being upset. Francie said,
"Ding! O-M-G! It's not like the two of you have ever been exclusive, is it? And it didn't mean anything. It was only a bit of fun. It was only sex, him and me, in 20 minutes, if it was even that long."
"You mean—"
Ding's lips were so dry she thought they might split as she went on to say,
"You mean that after I slammed the door on you two, you actually— You went on, like you're caught in the act, but that didn't matter?"
"But why should it?
And we gone up there to—"
"I don't know what to say. Dingy, you've told me about the lads at Cardew Hall, that delivery bloke with the jars for your mum, the other one in the back of the church over Easter. What about the one doing the roof of the stables? Wasn't any of that true?"
"That's not the point," Ding said. "You knew me and Brutus, and we lived together, Francie."
"But not like in living together. I didn't think it would bother you, really. Do you think I would have done it?
And we didn't do it all the way like that, not to finish, because he couldn't. Not in my mouth, that is. So I had to—"
"Stop it!"
Ding shrieked then, and her hands flew up as if on their own accord to cover her ears.
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry," Francie cried. "If I'd known he actually meant something to you—"
"He doesn't. I thought he did, but he doesn't."
Francie looked away in the direction of the door. Miss Maxwell was striding purposefully towards them. She said in a rush,
"I didn't mean anything by it. And what I said about the threesome, it was just what popped into my head. But I saw your face, and I knew straight away that you were upset, only I didn't know exactly why, because of all the blokes at Cardew Hall. And are there any other blokes, Sting? Is it just Brutus? Because if it is, I want to die right here, because I wouldn't have meant ever to hurt you.
It was me being stupid, that's all it was. Ladies, if we can draw this tête-à-tête to a conclusion...
As Maxwell's voice was heavy with meaning.
Ding. Dingy,
was the last ding heard, as she rushed for the door. She was beginning to cry, and she didn't know why, and she didn't want even to hazard a guess about where the tears were coming from. For the truth was that she had never misled Francie about the various blokes at Cardew Hall, and what she'd done with them, and where. There were more, even, than she'd ever told Francie. But the additional truth was that Brutus had always meant something more to her, only she knew who he was, and she knew what he was, and she didn't know what to do about either. Ludlow, Shropshire. Linley took on the search for Ian Druitt's Hillman while Havers remained at the hotel with his mobile phone, a charger, provided, as they had hoped, by reception, and a list of the birthdays and the phone numbers of all members of his immediate family, to include Aunt Uma as well. For his part, Linley decided to begin with the close environs of St. Lawrence Church, on the remote chance that Ian Druitt had managed to park nearby, in a place that was not marked by any restrictions. He set off from the hotel and headed towards Castle Square once again. He found it quite crowded now. Three nearby tour coaches had recently deposited their loads of visitors at the top of Mill Street, and a number of them had invaded the market for a look at the bric-a-brac stalls. Rather than attempt to work his way through the throng, Linley kept to the pavement and only crossed the square at its east end. There he saw that Harry Rochester and his fellow floggers were in the process of being moved along by the town's PCSO. This would be Gary Ruddock, he reckoned, a solid-looking bloke of some 6 feet tall, with a thick but fatless waist and round face. He appeared a bit older than Linley had anticipated. He had assumed the officer would be round 21 or so, but this man looked closer to 30. He and Harry Rochester were in conversation. It didn't look either unpleasant or aggressive. Linley didn't approach them, but instead crossed over the square behind them and entered the environs of St. Lawrence Church. The route took him down one of the town's cobbled streets, little more than the width of the ancient carts that would have been used by merchants who served the castle's inhabitants, and deposited him in College Street, opposite the church. Midway along its route he saw the first of the available parking spots, but he also saw the restrictions posted as Mr. Spencer had indicated. The parking in the street was reserved for residents. Visitors were restricted to 2 hours only and would be towed thereafter. The street itself was residential, a mixture of plaster-fronted and red-brick buildings heading northwards into Linney Street. Here, too, were residences of slightly later vintage than those near the church, overlooking the River Corve. Here, too, the parking was restricted and the signage indicated again what would happen to violators of the restrictions. Had Ian Druitt parked anywhere in the immediate vicinity of the church, then his Hillman would have been towed away, possibly the very same night that he died. Before ringing the phone number given on the warning signs, Linley decided to check the closest car park to be certain. His town plan showed it behind West Mercia College, accessed on the north side of Castle Square. A short walk on a pleasant day, he thought. Returning to the square put him once again on the edge of the market, where he saw that the blanket floggers had now dispersed. The PCSO he caught sight of at the far west end of the square, where a small white caravan stood. From this, various types of grilled sausages were filling the air with the idea of lunch. Ruddock was in conversation with a man who appeared to be the caravan's owner, and he was indicating some sort of instructions about the placement of a sandwich board that listed the food options and their prices. It was apparently blocking access to West Mercia College's grounds, because when the officer walked on, the sign was moved, although the bloke moving it didn't look especially happy about having to do so. Linley turned away to seek out the car park, which was easy to find behind the college buildings. As there was a pay-and-display machine, he reckoned the Hillman would have been removed long ago had it been here in the first place. Nonetheless, he thought it best to check. The car park was crowded, students' vehicles, he supposed, but as it wasn't an enormous area, it didn't take him more than 10 minutes to walk it. There was nothing there as old as a 1962 Hillman, although a Volkswagen camper van in wretched condition came fairly close. The phone number for the towing service was, as before, posted in several locations. Rather than going on to check the car park near the town's library, Linley decided to ring the service for the location of whatever impound facility they used. He had luck with this, for there was one impound yard only, and he was told he could find it 2 miles to Ludlow's northeast on the A4117 beyond Rock Green. He would recognise the place by the large, revolving pink elephant in front of it. God knew why the yard owners had chosen that device, but no one looking for the place ever got lost. Linley rang the impound yard next, as there was no point in trekking out to it, even to see the revolving pink elephant, if the hillman wasn't there. But a conversation with the telephone receptionist, followed by an interminable wait during which he spied two college students exchanging cash for a small plastic bag of what was doubtless an illegal substance, gave him the information he was looking for. Yes, they had a 1962 Hillman in the impound yard. Was he the owner? No, Linley told them. He was the police. The owner was dead, and they were seeking his vehicle. Who's paying the fine, then? There's a towing charge and an impound charge, you know. Linley said he would pay it. It was easier than going through the legal manoeuvres necessary to wrench the vehicle from the impound yard's grasp without paying. As the location was out of town, and since he wanted to take possession of the vehicle, Linley rang for a taxi to cart him there. He waited at the top of Mill Street, and soon enough the taxi showed up, driven by a grandmotherly sort, with the vehicle's radio playing classic, but mercifully soft, rock and roll. They wound through the town, the driver informing him there was no direct route to Rock Green. Thus he was more or less a victim to Where the Boys Are, followed by Judy's Turn to Cry, followed by Johnny Angel. The revolving pink elephant came into view in the midst of Tell Laura I Love Her. Linley paid the driver and wondered how he'd managed to escape such teenage angst. But then he'd had larger things to concern him when he was 16 years old. A dying father, a mother having an affair with his cancer specialist, a lost soul of a younger brother, and his own confusion and grief. Inside the impound yard, he went to a caravan that appeared to serve both as living accommodation and as an office for the owners of the place. A couple in the vicinity of 70 wearing matching boiler suits with their names embroidered upon them. He was Totally Roger, and she was the Absolute Lucinda, who seemed to do double duty as the receptionist. Linley showed his warrant card, told the couple what he was after, explaining once again that the owner of the Hillman, one Ian Druitt, had died in March. The name meant nothing to either Totally Roger or the Absolute Lucinda, but the fact that Linley was a Met officer did. They went round a bit in the area of, "So what did he do, this bloke, Roger?" and, "Were you lot after him, Lucinda?" And they seemed reluctant to part with the vehicle unless some kind of additional proof could be offered that D.I. Linley was indeed authorized to relieve them of it. Linley wondered at the fact that they would even want to keep the ancient vehicle on their premises, but he reckoned that they had few enough chances to make the police dance round for them, so he indicated that he could get formal authorization to take the vehicle, but it was likely that doing so was going to rob them of 2 months' payment for having stored it if they went that route. That decided matters in a quick fashion, and after the Absolute Lucinda ran Linley's credit card through its paces, Totally Roger showed him the way to the Hillman. The wily couple had already moved it to the end of one of the rows of vehicles. They'd known they were on the losing side of the situation, and they'd decided to play it for what they could get. Linley thanked Roger and looked the vehicle over when the man left him to it. He saw that the Hillman's tires were virtually threadbare, and there was quite a dent in the front right wing. But otherwise the car was exactly as Clive Druitt had described it, old, rusting round the wheel wells and decorated with 1960s transfers on its rear window. The original owner had been a concert-goer, it appeared. He'd memorialized his attendance at various musical venues, but Clive Druitt had been correct. The Kinks were first in that person's heart, followed by the Stones. Linley unlocked the vehicle and swung open the driver's door. By its condition, he saw the upholstery was as original as the rest of the vehicle appeared to be. It needed repairing or replacing. Seams were split on the driver's seat, and the upper part of the back seat's cushion bore a lot of damage from the sun. Linley sat inside and tried the ignition. The Hillman, unburdened by modern electronics that wore on a car's battery, started without difficulty. He drove it to one side of the impound yard, shut it off, and began a more thorough look through it. He began with the boot, where he discovered that Ian Druitt was not exactly neat in his automotive habits. Aside from the tools to change a tyre, although there was no spare tyre at all, Druitt had a collection of ratty-looking wool blankets stored inside. On top of these, and to the side, 5 tins of motor oil suggested that the Hillman burned more than its fair share. 3 more tins were empty and waiting for someone to discard them. Smashed into the back of the boot was an ancient pullover, and beneath it a sticky roller for removing lint sprouted a very thick beard of animal fur. This was explained by the presence of 2 humane traps, both of which were marked with tags that read, Feral Cat Rescue, with a phone number beneath it. There was nothing else inside the boot save dust and dirt, so he went next to the car's interior. Ian Druitt, he saw, had used the Hillman as a mobile office of sorts. On the back seat, Linley found manila filing folders in a cardboard container designed for this purpose. They were arranged in no particular order, and among them he discovered receipts for maintenance work done on the vehicle over the years, handbills for Hangdog Hillbillies, the whimsical-looking musical group that, according to Havers's report, he had been part of. Internet searches for street pastors programs in larger cities and towns in the UK. Another internet search on victim volunteers programs. A record dating back 10 years of petrol purchases, including the day of purchase and the cost of purchase and the mileage on the vehicle at the time. A collection of sermons given by various notable Anglican leaders, and a book of the collected poetry of William Butler Yeats, with a place mark at The Second Coming. Beneath this box was a large UK A to Z, circa 20 years earlier, with dog-eared pages attesting to its use. He flipped through this, but there was nothing unusual about it, no X marking a spot that indicated a special destination that Druitt had had in mind. Oddly, the floor of the back seat held a galvanized wash tub, and placed, so it leaned at an angle from the floor to the ceiling of the vehicle, was a broomstick, with no actual broom straw, but rather with a heavy string attached to it. Linley frowned at this and wondered for a moment, until he understood this was the deacon's contribution to Hangdog Hillbillies, a wash-tub base. He flipped the passenger seat back into position, sat in it, and opened the glove box. Here he discovered that Druitt had worn prescription sunglasses, which he carefully kept in a leather case. There were also folded documents attesting to his ownership of the vehicle and his possession of insurance. An ROC membership card had been pushed to the back, and a brochure for National Trust properties indicated that he might have been interested in the nation's religious, architectural, or aristocratic history. What was most interesting, though, was the first indication they'd had that the man might have been sexually active. A container of condoms was part of the glove box's contents. When Linley opened it, he saw that half of the original 20 were missing. Ludlow, Shropshire. The one thing Barbara knew for certain at the end of her first hour with Ian Druitt's mobile phone was that the UK would have fallen to Nazi Germany had she been sent to do anything at Bletchley Park. In D.I. Linley's absence, she'd used every birthday trying to unlock the device. She'd done them forwards, then she'd done them backwards. She'd also mixed them up, a spontaneous idea that resulted in her complete confusion. She went from there to street addresses Clive Druitt had provided her, and still there was no joy to be had. To keep the bloody thing from locking up on her, she'd shut it down and rebooted it after each third attempt. But ultimately she called it quits. She then turned to Ian Druitt's engagement diary, and she'd worked backwards from the deacon's death in order to compare the names in the diary with Ludlow's telephone directory in an attempt to ring every person whose surname indicated an appointment had been at least made, if not kept, by or with the deacon. Not every name was in the local directory. She reckoned the individuals who went along with the names were either domiciled in another part of Shropshire, or they were simply ex-directory. Those people she'd managed to track down, however, seemed open enough about their connection to Ian Druitt. It ate up several hours, but Barbara was able to unearth a few details that, while not necessarily intriguing, at least added to their knowledge of Druitt's movements in the weeks before he died. When Linley arrived back from his search for Druitt's auto, she was outside of the hotel at the far end of the car park, giving herself a smoking break. It was with some amusement that she greeted the sight of the detective inspector rumbling onto the premises in a rattling Hillman. The only time she'd ever seen him in such an automotive disaster was on the very few occasions when she'd been able to entice him into her Mini. That he'd pollute the seams of his bespoke suit by exposing them to the interior of Druitt's motor was a particularly enjoyable sight. He parked near her and climbed from the vehicle. She said to him, "That's the motor, eh? It sounds worse than mine, and I didn't think that was possible." "Its interior is remarkably similar as well," he told her, "save the empty takeaway cartons, of course. The deacon appears to have taken his meals at home."
"Or he used rubbish bins."
"There is that." Linley hoisted a few items out of the car.
"Found anything of an evidentiary nature?" she asked.
"A fully lived life, but not much else." He said he'd leave her to her habit and told her that he would wait for her in the residence lounge. She sucked down the rest of the fag quickly. When she went inside, he was laying manila folders out on a coffee table and telling Peace on Earth, who seemed to be rather too curious as he hovered round the room, that a cup of tea would be the very thing. Lapsang Souchong if they had it, Assam if they didn't.
Earl Grey?
Peace on Earth asked hopefully. That would be fine, Lindley told him. To Havers, he said, Sergeant, Earl Grey, or will that wash away the less than salubrious effects of your cigarette?
Amusing,
she said. I like PG tips, she told Peace on Earth, but I'll swill Earl Grey if I have to. When the young man went off to see to the tea, Lindley asked about Barbara's progress with the smartphone. She said it had been more or less a white flag exercise for her. On the other hand, she told him she did have something of a success with the Deacon's appointment diary and the Ludlow telephone directory. She'd stowed her notebook inside her bag while she was out indulging her habit, so she excavated for it, flipped it open, picked a piece of tobacco off her tongue, and began. She'd spoken to two sets of parents of children in the after-school club, she said, because Druid apparently scheduled meetings with parents, as noted in his diary, before a child's first attendance at a gathering of the club.
They loved him to bits, she told Lindley. Far as they were concerned, not a hint of anything going on, except guidance, school prep, outdoor activities, games and the like.
Druitt had also met with an individual from Birmingham, she went on. This was a woman who had begun an effective street pastors program there to help the city cope with young people out in the streets late at night.
Clubbing, binge-drinking, drugs, she said. The regular thing. Only now they have a sobering up center for them. The street pastors go out, gather them up, and bring them back to where they serve up soup and coffee and tea and sandwiches and whatever else. The deacon was trying to set up a system like that here. I expect Gary Ruddick was on board with that. We'll need to have a word there, because he was the one having to do it all, and probably would have been dead chuffed to have some helpers.
She pointed out the name McMurrah, which appeared several times in the lead-up to Ian Druitt's death. This, she said, was one Declan McMurrah, and the relationship there had to do with cats. Catch, neuter and release, Lindley said. There are traps in the boot of Druitt's car.
McMurrah's, though, sir, Barbara told him. He asked me about him when I phoned. Big cat lover, he is.
She went on with Randy, Blake and Stu, the sole Christian names in the diary. These were members of Hangdog Hillbillies, as it turned out. She only worked this out when she was looking through one of Clive Druitt's delivered boxes. There was a handbill with the names of the other musicians. Randy on banjo, Blake on guitar, Stu on percussion. No surnames, though, so she couldn't track them down, although she reckoned she and Lindley could go to one of their venues, where they'd probably find someone who knew their full names if that was necessary. Spencer's, in the diary, was obvious, as Druitt had written it on the dinner hour three times. Two other names turned out to be individuals whom the deacon had checked on in the custody suite at the Shrewsbury station. Lindley picked up one of the manila folders at this. It had been among several others that he'd removed from the carton he'd brought in from Druitt's Hillman. He said, "He has information here about the independent custody visiting program.
Everyone told me last time I was here that the bloke was a volunteering machine."
Anything else from the names in the diary?
Three are shut-ins who belong to the parish. One was in hospital at the time. Four are victims of crimes. Not big stuff, this. Petty crimes, although one was a mugging that involved a head wound.
That's another volunteer program he's got information about, Lindley told her. He fingered through the folders and handed her one. Victim volunteers, he said. As she opened it and gave the contents a look, he added, It is curious, though.
What is?
Even by the standards of a man of God, it does seem like an extraordinary amount of volunteering.
That's what me and the Gov thought first time through.
Barbara reflected on everything she'd learned on her earlier trip to the town and added,
Mr. Spencer told me Druitt couldn't manage to pass the tests to become a full priest, or whatever they're called, sir. He took it five times and it was still no go, owing to his nerves.
Could be this, she gestured at what they had before them, was his answer to not being able to serve God and his fellow man the way he wanted to serve. Lindley nodded, but he looked thoughtful. He said, There were condoms in the car as well. A box of 20. 10 were left. What does that suggest to you?
He could have been handing them out to the lads round town. I mean, the older boys, sir. That's more or less in character, don't you think?
Anything else?
The obvious. He had a lady friend somewhere and was being careful. Odd, though.
That he had a lady friend? She shook her head.
That we haven't run into her name, or even a whisper about her. On the other hand,
she lifted the deacon's diary and said,
Here's something, sir. There's this Lomax person, a woman.
You suspect the condoms have to do with her?
Not hardly. unless he liked grannies. The governor, I met her. She looks round 70.
So where does she take you?
She's in his diary 7 times, she is. She told me and the gov she was meeting with Druitt because her family was in a crisis and she needed to talk to someone about it.
Is that unreasonable?
He is a clergyman, after all. Yeah, but she told us herself she wasn't religious, and she was vague when it came to how she connected with him in the first place. Plus, there's this, sir. Druitt didn't counsel anyone. I mean, all the people I've talked to so far, every single one of them, they said he was a lovely bloke and all the rest, but none of them went to him to get themselves counselled, spiritually or otherwise. And the Lomax woman? She had a solicitor there when we talked to her. You ask me, there's something in that needing another look.
Let's see about looking, then, Linley said. St. Julian's Well, Ludlow, Shropshire. When Rabia Lomax opened the door and found Officer Dowdy, whose name she could not recall, and her companion, Mr. Well-Dressed, standing on her front step, she gave brief thought to ringing Aeschylus, but she didn't do so. She had other things that she needed to see to on this evening, and primary among them was ringing the members of the Maintenance and Repairs Committee to lasso the lot of them into a meeting. Sending for Aeschylus would require her to wait for Aeschylus. She decided it would be far easier to handle these two herself and shoo them on their way. Officer Dowdy was the first one to speak, saying to her, "Mrs. Lomax, can we have a word, please? This is D.I. Linley. Sorry, but we're back in the traces. We'd like to confirm a bit of this and that with you. Do you want to ring your solicitor?"
That was an interesting twist, Rabia thought, as she racked her brains for the woman's name. When did coppers ever begin with an invitation to bring on the legal advocates? Certainly not on any telly-programme she'd ever seen. Usually they wanted the opposite. She said, "I'm sorry, but I can't remember your name."
"Barbara Havers," Dowdy said. "Can we have a word? Has something happened?" "Should something have happened?" "I hardly know. I certainly don't have any further information to give you about Mr. Druitt. Is that why you've come?"
In pear-shaped tones that matched his clothing, which, while beautifully made, also screamed worn by a retainer for a year to make the items look suitably lived in, the detective inspector said, "Sergeant Havers and I have been asked to look into something related to Mr. Druitt's death."
"Didn't you lot do that once already?" "I don't know what I could add to what I've already told you,"
Sergeant Havers said.
"You did give us a bit of information, right, but then something more came up, and here we are. Can we come in?"
Rabia looked behind herself, almost as a reflex, since she couldn't have said why she did it. She said, "I suppose," and she didn't attempt to make her voice sound friendly. She stepped back to give them entry. She made no offer of refreshments, and she wasn't happy when Sergeant Havers asked her for a glass of water. The other officer made the same request, which made her immediately suspicious, as this smacked of an advance plan of some kind. She wanted to tell them that they could take themselves off to a shop and purchase a bottle of water each, but she reckoned it might start all of them off on the wrong foot. So she went to fetch the water, 2 glasses, each half full, and she joined them in the sitting room. She was just in time to see the sergeant returning a framed photo to the fireplace mantel. A glance told her what it was. Once again, the photo of the glider pilot's consortium jauntily standing in front of the craft they had purchased.
"Here we are, then?"
Rabia handed each of them a glass. Neither drank. They were, she decided, trying to unnerve her. She was determined not to be unnerved.
"How can I help you this time round?"
The detective inspector gave the merest of nods at the sergeant. If Rabia hadn't been directing her gaze to him as the superior officer, she wouldn't have caught it at all, so slight a movement it was. The sergeant said,
"Right then. We spent a bit of time contacting everyone in Mr. Druitt's diary. That will be the diary that has your name in it. Now, we haven't made contact with every single name. He was one busy bloke. But a pattern's emerged, and we'd like to ask you about it." "I doubt I can shed any light on a pattern in someone's diary, Sergeant." "Perhaps yes, perhaps no," she said cheerfully. "Turns out Mr. Druitt had his fingers in a massive pile of social responsibility pies. Also turns out that the individuals he saw, the names we ran down from his diary, I mean, all fit into one or another of these pies."
She used her own fingers as she named them, and Rabia could tell she was doing it to make a point.
"We've got the Children's Club kiddos and their parents, a street pastor's programme, a crime victim's programme, the custody visitor's programme that took him up to Shrewsbury to make certain the cells were all squeaky clean, the church choir and the neighbourhood watch where he lived. We've also got meetings with the mayor and with 3 town councillors."
Rabia tried to look interested in this information.
She could feel a pencil line of perspiration breaking out along her hairline, though. She said,
"I'm not sure what your point is, or indeed why you've come calling. Have you been here for days interviewing everyone in Mr. Druitt's diary?"
"Good question, that," Sergeant Havers acknowledged, with a jaunty single-finger salute from her forehead. "I did this bit by phone, since every name, except the mayor and the town councillors, was only in the diary once."
"Your point still escapes me," Rabia said.
"It's this. When we were here last, me and my main gov, DCS Ardrey this was, you told us that you and the deacon met because you were talking over a family situation."
"That's correct. That's what I said, and that's what we did."
"Right. But the odd thing we came up with is that Mr. Druitt did never meet with anyone about family problems. I guess you could argue, of course, that family problems are why some of the little ones probably got sent to the children's club, eh? But all of this made me wonder if there's anything about your explanation that you want to change."
She finally paused to take a sip of her water. The other officer, Rabia noticed, still had not touched his.
"What explanation is this?" Rabia asked. Her voice sounded too faint. That wouldn't do.
"The explanation telling me and my gov, DCS Ardrey, like I said, that you and Mr. Druitt were talking about your family. 7 times, talking about your family."
Rabia knew it was time for her to come up with something more specific, and she wished desperately that she made notes of what she'd told them initially, but she hadn't done, so she had no choice save to bluff her way forward and get them out of her life. She said,
"Mr. Druitt and I spoke about my eldest son."
"Makes you special, that," the sergeant said. "You been the only person he counselled?"
"I suppose it does make me special," Rabia countered,
and after a pause during which she recognised that the police were waiting for something more from her, which she was perfectly determined not to give them,
"is there anything else, then? Perhaps you can tell us what you spoke about regarding your son."
Surely, Rabia thought, the woman had it in her notes. She wanted to tell her to bloody look through them, but she wanted them gone from her house more. She said,
"I did tell you. It was a family situation."
"And there are so many," the sergeant said. She looked solemn and anticipatory at the same time.
"What was this one?"
"I don't see how it's the business of the police," she said.
"Oh, it's not at all. Except, of course, the bloke you talked to about your family situation turned up dead."
"Are you implying there's a connection?
As I've said, I spoke to him about my son David. He will be the one whose daughter died."
"No, that's Tim,"
she said before she understood what had just occurred. The sergeant nodded.
"Got it," she said. "Only last time we were here, you told us it was the one whose daughter died who was being talked about. A user, he is. Drugs? Alcohol? What you will?"
Rabia said, "Both of my sons are users, Sergeant. One is recovering and one is not. I probably talked to Mr. Druitt about both of them during those 7 meetings he and I had, since Tim's daughter had died and David's wife and children had recently left him. One doesn't cease being involved in one's children's lives simply because the children are grown. You'll understand that at some point, if you don't understand it now."
She rose then and settled her hands on her hips.
"Is there anything else I can help you with?"
The sergeant looked at the inspector. He'd remained watchful and unnervingly silent, but all the time he'd kept his gaze on Rabia. Despite a smallish scar that marked his upper lip, he was a handsome man, quiet and solemn in just the way she'd always thought a man should be. Seen, admired, perhaps flirted with, and without opinions that wanted declaration. He finally spoke the first words he'd uttered since coming into the house. "Nothing else just yet," he said.
St. Julian's Well, Ludlow, Shropshire. Linley could tell when Havers was about to start pulling on the bit. There were generally 2 signs. The first was her gait, which altered from her usual saunter to something akin to a charge, heading into the wind when there was no wind. The second was her expression, which could either telegraph the triumph of gotcha, or the absolute knowledge of what had to be done next to make gotcha approximate certainty. As they headed towards his car, she was demonstrating both gait and expression.
"You saw her, right?"
Her voice was low, and she looked round furtively as if expecting someone with a recording device to jump out of a nearby window box.
"I did, but I'm uncertain where the coincidence takes us."
She halted in the middle of the street.
"How about the fact that it's not a coincidence?"
He glanced back at the house.
well-kept, tidy, nothing sinister about it, a house like the others in the street. He said, "Rabia Lomax and Clover Freeman are in a photo together, posing along with 8 or 10 individuals in front of a glider, which I assume they all pilot. I'm presuming they're a club of some sort." Havers ignored the question, because, as it turned out, she had a piece of information that she was determined to give him.
"Yes, yes, but forget Rabia Lomax. It's not about her, it's about the other."
"Clover Freeman?"
"Nancy Scannell."
"Who?"
"Nancy Scannell, sir. She's in the same picture, with Clover Freeman and Mrs. Lomax. She's one of the pilots. She's also the forensic pathologist who did the autopsy on Ian Druitt. She's who called his death a suicide. So do you see now?"
What Linley saw was that Havers could well be too excited by half. In fact, he saw that Nancy Scannell's membership, if it could be called that, in the glide group, was less coincidence than the coincidence of Clover Freeman and Rabia Lomax both being members. He said, "Barbara, think about it. How is this significant? It makes perfect sense that two individuals who are professionally acquainted might discover a commonality between them. Is there a gliding airfield round here?"
"Up on the Long Mynd, yes. And when we went up there, me and the Gov, we went to talk to Nancy Scannell. That's where she wanted to meet us, because she was helping someone launch a glider that day. And then later we discovered that Rabia Lomax was part of the same glider group. They all own the glider together. Which, you ask me, is totally coincidental in a seriously non-coincidental way."
"Nonsense," Linley argued. "I doubt there's more than one airfield for gliding in Shropshire. So if there's a local centre for the sport, it's even more likely that these two women, professionally related, Barbara, would discover they share a mutual interest in gliding. They might well have run into each other at the airfield. Or there could have been a notice on a bulletin board asking for interested parties to contact someone about purchasing a glider together. They could have discussed the idea of ownership, or they could have hit upon it separately, only to discover at the first meeting of potential owners that they both are pilots and that they both wanted to be part of the group. My point is that there are a number of explanations, and none of them can actually be labelled suspicious."
"But my point is..."
"The point is that it's just that, a point of interest. Something to be noted for now, but that's all. It may be useful, but it may be a wild hare, and I trust you know better than to follow it simply because you can apply a label to it." She looked away from him, and he could see from the set of her face that she was prepared to argue the point a few more rounds. He stopped her with, "Check your phone. Let's see if Ruddock has tried to make contact." They'd rung the PCSO before setting off from the hotel, but the call had gone directly to message. Havers had asked him to ring as soon as he could. She hadn't told him why. During their conversation with Rabia Lomax, however, she'd put the mobile on mute. She brought it out now as directed. She said to Linley,
"Nothing yet.
So don't you think we ought to..." "What I think is that we need to take care not to get ahead of ourselves. One thing at a time, Sergeant."
"Time," she said. "Isn't that just it? Isn't that exactly what we don't have?"
"We're not at the point of desperation, Barbara." Her expression, however, suggested otherwise. 18th May. Worcester, Herefordshire. Trevor Freeman woke into darkness, feeling like a man put into suspended animation for a 100-year journey into space. For a moment he wished that he actually were inside one of those science fiction capsules, because regaining consciousness brought into his head a score of mental images that he could have done without. They got the better of him quickly, and just as quickly he tried to dismiss them, but to no avail. They took their strength from their very sources. Two of these were overheard snippets of conversation on the previous evening. The other rose from his own stupid, unquenchable, libidinous behaviour. Gaz Ruddock had joined them for dinner as invited by Trevor at his wife's request, but the unsatisfactory conversation he'd earlier had with Clover, touching on the topic of the PCSO and the convoluted nature of how the dinner invitation had to be extended to the young man, had roused Trevor's suspicions. As a result, he'd become hypersensitive to everything, both during the meal and afterwards. They'd had their steak, potatoes, salad, and pudding on the patio, and from start to finish each word, action, tone of voice, and glance seemed supercharged to him. Clover's choice of apparel hadn't helped. Round him she always dressed with an understated sexiness, but for some reason
She decided to bypass understatement altogether in her selection of cropped trousers showing off the best ankles in Christendom, sandals, one of which she continuously swung from her big toe, and a top fashioned to fall off her shoulder. Perhaps in a declaration that she'd had to dress hastily, she hadn't put on a bra, so her nipples made a perky statement on her chest that it would have taken a blind man to ignore. Of course, she'd taken care to have an excuse for this clothing, hadn't she? She was clever that way. He'd been in the kitchen flipping steaks in the marinade when he'd heard her return from work. She'd joined him briefly, saying that she would be available to help out once she'd changed from uniform into something more comfortable. He was having a look at the baking potatoes in the oven when she called from above.
"Trev, can you possibly help me?"
And since he had the marinade doing its bit, and the potatoes were fine, and all that was left was the salad, he went up to see what Clover needed. He'd found her in their bedroom, where she had altered herself to a nun. He realized that the costume must have been in a package on their doorstep that he'd found upon returning home for the day. It had also contained the costume for a priest, he reckoned, since she'd laid this out on the bed for him to get into prior to carrying on with what she obviously had in mind. He would be the Catholic priest, seduced by the nun. Or she would be the pious nun, seduced by the priest in the midst of her prayers. That one seemed more likely, as she'd also fashioned a prie-dieu by dragging the ottoman over to a chest of drawers. She was kneeling upon it as she fingered her beads. She'd turned as he entered the room. She wore on her face the expression of a young Madonna. She held out her hand to him and made clear what the coming event was meant to be, saying,
"Father, will you hear my confession?"
He'd had not a moment's hesitation about his desire to play along. Nonetheless, there was something of a problem, the factor of time. He said, "I would do gladly." She glanced at the bed where his priest togs lay.
"Do you need to put on your garments, Father?"
"That I do, and again, gladly. Unfortunately, you've forgotten. Gaz is coming to dinner." She was Clover in an instant.
"Damn! I saw the package and completely forgot."
Then she laughed.
"Well, I must be quick, then. I did think the Randy priest would be the one to orchestrate things, but never mind. Come over here, darling, see what Sister Mary Rosary Beads has in mind for you."
"You're the naughty one, aren't you?"
"Always. Come along, Father Freeman."
He'd laughed. "Clover, truly, there's no time."
"Oh, yes, there is. You'll be surprised what I can accomplish in—"
The doorbell had gone then, and he'd said, "I expect 20 seconds is beyond even your talents, girl. It'll have to wait, and I hope it does." He crossed to her, bent and kissed her, easing his hand between her legs to caress her, and then dodging as she reached for his zip. He went off and answered the door. He'd welcomed Gaz Ruddock into their house. Her proposed encounter should have been sufficient to occupy his mind for the evening until such a time as they could don their respective costumes. Indeed, those moments in the bedroom might well have sufficed to make him blind to everything else save his own anticipation, had he not overheard Gaz saying to Clover, "We can always have a go, if—" a remark that he cut off abruptly as Trevor had come out of the house onto the patio with her after pudding coffees. And then Gaz switched quickly to a compliment on the meal and a stated wish that he could man a barbecue like Trev. Trevor, however, hadn't been easily thrown off the track of what he'd heard, so he said, "And what are you having a go at, you two?" as pleasantly as he could manage.
"This Scotland Yard business,"
had been Clover's reply.
"You know how he can be if he's pushed."
"Who?"
"Finnegan. Who else?"
He'd taken a deliberate moment to let the question hang there before he said,
"I don't know. Perhaps you ought to tell me."
It had to be said that Clover looked mildly surprised at this, but she went on with,
"If the Met want a second round with him, they'll be rougher. I'd like to be there if they show up. Failing that, I'd like Gaz to be there."
It would have been nice to name this exchange a deliberate dodging of the question, but he couldn't do so, as it made perfect sense. He told himself it was only his desire for Clover that was making him so attuned to anything smacking of someone else's desire. He might have held on to that thought straight into the night, had he not also heard the softly spoken goodbye Clover had offered Gaz as he'd departed.
"We'll speak later,"
begged the questions. What exactly would they speak about? Why the secrecy? Why the murmur to ensure her husband did not hear? These were the queries first on his mind then, when she shut the door on the PCSO and her gaze fell upon her husband, whom she'd obviously not expected to be standing so close behind her. But before he could ask for answers, she excused herself with a,
"Darling, I've got to run upstairs for a moment."
And off she went. From there it had been such a simple matter for Clover, hadn't it?
He'd been gathering the barbecue implements for cleaning when she returned to him outside on the patio. She'd donned the nun's costume another time, but with a difference. As she slid into his presence, she was wearing only the veil and the wimple, with the rosary beads fastened round her waist. His first thought was, "Christ, the neighbours!" as he looked round for eyes, eagerly watching from the windows overlooking their back garden. But he had no chance to remonstrate, for Clover came towards him, and she declared, "Sister Mary Rosary Beads has something very special for you," as she put her hands on the waist of his jeans. Although it was an utter lie, because already he felt the belly heat within him, he said, "I'm that done in, Clover. It'll have to be another night." "Surely not," she said, and her fingers moved to lower his zip. He pointed out that Gaz had stayed later than Trevor expected him to. She said piously, "You know the will of God must always come first, Trev." "Must it?" he said, as her cool, smooth fingers moved against his flesh. "It must." She mounted the patio table. She crooked her finger. She spread her legs. "Come along," she whispered. "God's will be done." Which it was, of course. Which he'd known it would be, because when it came to Clover, he was weak as a dying fish with a hook in its mouth. And not only there had God's will been done, but later again in the bedroom, where, after the washing up in the kitchen, he'd found her as she'd been earlier in the evening, a nun at her beads. This time she was fully clothed in the costume, and she became all surprise and fear to see that a stranger had somehow broken into her cell where she was solemnly praying. He was, damn him, only too happy to find her thus, and to play the stranger come to take her against her virginal will, which her terrified, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" told him he was meant to be. Afterwards they collapsed together and had fallen asleep. That was the thing about Clover. He'd allowed her to know him better than anyone, and what she knew best was that he'd remained like a randy 16-year-old boy when it came to her, and most of the reason for this had to do with her crazy sex games. Clover knew that the single simplest way to derail him, distract him, and deny him access to her scheming mind was to give him access to her perfect body. Now in the early morning he stirred in their bed. His body smelled rank, even to himself. A shower was called for, but instead he dressed in tracksuit and trainers and descended the stairs. He could hear the rapid whirring of Clover's stationary bicycle in the conservatory. She was going at a clip that he could not possibly have maintained. That was another thing about her, the importance she gave to staying in condition. Prior to the past few days, he had always assumed her reasons had to do with her father, whose sedentary life as a psychoanalyst and whose personal habits as a heavy drinker and heavier smoker had resulted in his premature death at 54 years old. She'd always claimed that she had no intention of following in her father's footsteps, and while Trevor had admired her single-minded dedication to staying fit, it was, after all, how they'd first met, back in the days when he, too, was a fitness aficionado instead of employing other individuals to be, he could see it as something that served another purpose entirely, keeping her body youthful, tight, and firm in all the right places. And not necessarily for him. He went into the conservatory, where the early morning's darkness was just about to give way to dawn. It was still night enough that he could see his reflection in the glass, a little haggard, a little more dumpy, growing jowls where a jaw should be solid and strong. Clover didn't notice him as she was concentrating on her aerobic workout, dripping sweat onto the towels that she'd laid at the base of a stationary bike. She was wearing headphones. He crossed in front of her and sat on the bench that was part of her stationary gym. She looked up, and he could see that he'd startled her, as he was generally abed till 7. She removed the headphones and continued to pump apace. He had no doubt that the woman possessed the heart of a 20-year-old. A buzzer sounded, calling an end to her aerobic session. She went into her cool-down period, breathing hard and pumping now at a slower pace. She sat straight up and said the obvious. "You're out of bed early. I didn't wake you, did I?" "Bugger that for a lark. I was in a coma. I thought you might have given me something."
"I did give you something. 2 somethings. You seemed to enjoy them as much as I did. Want more? That can be arranged."
He knew he was supposed to leer at this, rising from the bench and going to her in order to slide his hand up her thigh. If he went for it, they would end up where she wanted them to be, and he would end up yet another time in the position of telling himself that she was 1 in a million, which made him 1 in a million when it came to luck, and why the bloody hell couldn't he just enjoy his life with her without rocking any boats. But so soon after their 2 encounters on the previous night, This offer of hers was more than just Clover having yet another itch that could only be scratched in a single manner. Trevor could see from her expression that she had concluded something was wrong. He should have slept in, as he would have done in other circumstances. She spoke first. He understood from this that she recognized the necessity of getting the advantage. Still, what she said surprised him.
"I have a confession to make. Will you hear me out?"
He was at once wary. What sort of confession?
"The sex was deliberate last evening. I did want you, but it's not fair if I pretend that I didn't have something else on my mind."
Trevor had hardly thought she'd go straight to the point. He wasn't sure what to make of it, which was what he said to her. In reply, she said,
"It's just that I didn't want to get on to Finnegan with you last evening."
Another surprise. He frowned, saying, "What about Finn, exactly?" She was slowing up on the stationary bike, and she reached for her water bottle and drank half its contents.
"You're not going to approve."
"I'm listening." She drew a long breath, then blew it out quickly, saying,
"I have an arrangement with Gaz.
You won't ever to know, but I can tell. You can't hide things from me, and I could see last night that you were closing in on it.
Trev, you and I, it's just that we've never seen eye to eye on Finnegan, have we? And now he's in Ludlow with all sorts of freedoms he didn't have here, and what with that scheme to go to Spain that he cooked up last Christmas. You see, I had to consider. Well, you know him, Trevor."
What Trevor knew was that it was completely unlike her to look for words, which told him something was up and he wasn't going to like it. He said, "Why don't you tell me directly what you want to tell me?" She slowed her peddling even more, but she didn't look as if she was ready to dismount. She said,
"It's this. I've asked Gaz to keep an eye out."
"What do you mean?"
"I've asked him to watch over Finnegan. I've asked him to let me know if Finnegan... Well, if he goes off track, you know how he can be. That reckless part of him. And what with the freedom to drink as much as he likes and to smoke weed, because you can't possibly think he isn't doing both in Ludlow, and with access now to other substances that kids his age use, I've been worried. And because I knew Gaz from the training centre, and I could see he was eager to do well whenever an officer asked him to do something, I thought he might be willing to keep Finnegan on his radar, even to look in on him now and again."
Trevor said nothing as he digested this. He could see that she was trying to read his expression, just as he was trying to read hers. She seemed to reach a conclusion, because she went on hurriedly with,
"I should have told you about the arrangement before now, but I knew you'd disapprove. I reckoned that Gaz could do everything on the sly, if you will. Finnegan wouldn't know, and neither would you. It would look like Gaz was just being friendly. But then with this Ian Druitt situation, it's all become something of a mess, and I don't want a mess between you and me. So I'm confessing."
Frustration had always cramped his gut when it came to Clover and their son. It did so now. Trevor said, "The real problem isn't Finn. It's your inability to sit with the uncertainty of will he or won't he. He's been showing you since he was 6 years old what happens when you insist on walking this path, Clover, but it's done no good."
"Darling, I admit I should have told you what I arranged when he got established in Ludlow, but I knew you'd argue against it."
"I'd argue against it because you keep making moves that are guaranteed to rile him, not to mention drive him towards the very things you want to keep him away from. Excessive drink, drugs, too many parties, whatever."
"I don't agree. And anyway, we go at things differently, you and I. We always have done."
"Christ, Clover." He rubbed his face and then his bare skull. "We can go at being parents as a result of our past, or we can go at it with knowledge of our past. Which of those two do you reckon describes this thing you've got going with Finn?"
"This thing? What thing? You sound like my father. This isn't about him, and it's not about my mother, or your father and mother and siblings gathered round the dinner table making happy families, which is what I know you wanted, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to give that to you, all right?"
Now that, he thought, was a very clever move. But he wasn't about to head in that direction. He said, "Agreed. Completely. It isn't about anyone except the two of us, how we see Finn and how Gaz Ruddock fits into the picture."
"What picture? I have Gaz keeping an eye out, full stop."
"Really? There's nothing more? Are you saying that this request of yours to Gaz comes out of absolutely nothing?"
"This request of mine comes out of the fact that Gaz is out and about all day in Ludlow. He sees things. He hears things. So how difficult could it possibly be for him to let me know how Finnegan's coping? This entire experience is new to Finnegan, being away from home, living with mates from the college, being exposed to choices he's never had before. I've been concerned, and to be honest, I can't understand why you haven't been, or why you've never been.
because you can't keep watch over a child every second. If you try to wrap him in cotton wool, I'm not doing that. She got off the bike then. She took up one of the towels on the floor and wiped herself energetically with it. She said, "Why can't you see that I'm only trying to be there for him as best I can? Oh, never mind. I don't want to talk about this as if I'm some sort of mentally defective individual who can't stop herself from intruding on her child's life. If you believe that your place just now is to tell Finnegan what his mother has organized for his own good, then go ahead." That said, she took up the other towel and her water bottle and left him sitting where he was. It was time for her weight training after her aerobics, but she'd apparently determined that weights were better left forgotten this morning. He decided he needed coffee. He went to the kitchen to make it. It was only when he heard the roar of the shower upstairs that he saw how Clover had derailed the conversation he'd intended them to have. Her bringing Finnegan into things was what had done it. How bloody clever the woman was. He'd learned nothing at all that she hadn't decided in advance he was meant to know. Ludlow, Shropshire. Linley had just finished his morning shower when he heard his mobile ringing. He had hopes that Deirdre was phoning him, but he saw that it was Isabel. He wasn't quite ready for whatever the DCS had in store in the way of conversation at 7 o'clock, so he let it go to message and returned to the bathroom, such as it was, to shave. His ingrained inclination to be ever the gentleman, allowing Barbara Havers to have the room Isabel had taken, had cost him this time. His bed was so abominable that he'd removed the mattress from its frame on the previous night and had slept upon it on the floor. The bathroom was suitable only for a munchkin, with a shower that was actually smaller than a telephone booth. There was a single oval mirror above the basin and nothing reflective at all in the bedroom, unless one counted the antique television set, which could, he supposed, be used in a pinch if the picture was off, the curtains were closed, and the weak overhead light was on. The resulting shadowy image might then be helpful, but only as far as a silhouette could carry things. He was wiping steam from the mirror when his mobile sounded another time. Another time he went to check it. Deirdre, he saw, and he felt a rush of gratification. When he answered, she said, "I suppose I ought to ask first if Barbara is practicing her tap dancing as ordered. As I have given her what is apparently the larger room, she ought to have space to do it. Whether she has the will remains to be seen. Should I ring Dorothea and recommend a pep talk? You know Barbara and pep talks. I think it's best to let Dee be surprised when she sees Barbara in action. We can only hope her tap shoes will be flashing, if tap shoes flash, that is. I'm uncertain of that part. I will say that my anticipation is building, however, although I'm keeping mum on what actually comprises my anticipation."
"You're very cruel."
"I must be cruel only to be kind, although I don't think Ophelia much appreciated the thought. How are you, darling? Are you at the zoo or still at home?" There was a pause. It was the darling. But he'd given her space with a follow-up question, and she seized upon that.
"Home, Tommy. But I think I must go to Cornwall."
Now there was irony, Linley thought, although he knew she certainly didn't mean that she planned to drop by Hounstow to press palms with his family. He said, "Has something happened?"
"Well, yes."
He heard her sigh. He wondered where in her flat she was at the moment, and he decided that she was in the kitchen that she'd remodelled, standing at the French windows overlooking the weed-choked ruin of a garden. She'd have made herself a cappuccino, no sweetener added. It would be on the kitchen's island, and she'd be turning just now to drink it. She'd be dressed, not for work, but for the drive to Cornwall, so what she wore would be comfortable for the journey, and her sandy hair would be drawn back from her face. The lenses of her specs would be newly cleaned, the smudges from yesterday carefully removed. She said,
"Gwinda rang last night. It's nearly time, if I want to say goodbye."
"Do you?"
"That's just it. I said goodbye so long ago that this part seems extraneous."
"Yes, I can see how that might be the case.
The difficult bit for me is trying to work out whether my reluctance to see her one last time is due to bitterness, anger, or a complete lack of grief."
"Perhaps it's all of that. Or none of that. Perhaps it's just natural reluctance. She wasn't actually a mother to you. She gave birth to you, but largely that was where things ended. For all of you, your brother and sister as well."
"I so want to be like Gwinda. I want to see our mother as someone who did the best she could do, but it's only that I've always had the worst time believing it."
"I doubt anyone who knows the circumstances would disagree, let alone cast stones if you decide not to go."
"It's my name, though. I mean my real name, Tommy. The one she gave me. As if she knew how it would all work out."
Edric. Yes, he said. It meant regret. It, like her birth in a lay-by in Cornwall, like her childhood in a caravan along a stream in which her father believed he could make his livelihood finding tin, was part of the past she'd been lifted out of when she and her siblings had been taken from their parents. It had been a case of complete neglect, no schooling, no health care, the environment unkempt,